Amateur Presentation.
Welcome back to another Untitled Movie Podcast. I am one of your hosts, Matt Rohrbeck, alongside, he's allergic to tomatoes, but he is tomato meter approved, Eric Marchin.
Matt, are you ready to play a double match of tennis? I know nothing of the sport.
You might know more now. Yes, today we are reviewing Luca Guadagnino's Challengers, starring Zendaya, Josh O'Connor, Mike Feist, and more, with music by Trent Reznor and Atticus Ross. And oh boy, Eric, am I excited to talk about this, because this fucking ripped, baby. This ripped.
Yeah, this is truly one of the most exciting sports movies I've ever seen. And when you're watching this thing, you just become completely locked into this one match. But it's fascinating. We'll get more into the movie in just a second. Having watched the first Slam Dunk last year and now this, the narrative structure is so similar in terms of, you know, staging, you know, the final game, the moment where it's like, okay, you know, the two teams are, you know, pitted against each other. But in order to understand how, you know, the characters of the story and to be emotionally attached to them, or, you know, root for them or against them, we need to understand who they are.
So we have to go back.
Exactly. Lost. Yeah. So throughout the film, you're cutting back to, you know, the individual player's story, or seeing a perspective of theirs. And then you're brought back into the game. And in doing so, what this does, and we talked about this when we reviewed How to Blow Up a Pipeline, there are very few movies that when they use a flashback, that it can take you out of the moment that you're already in, because you're so invested in what's going on, especially if it's as kinetic as what's going on in this final match between Josh O'Connor and Mike Feist's characters, you know, battling it out on the tennis court, and, you know, watching Zendaya as she, you know, the whole audience, you know, in unison goes back and forth, back and forth. And so, you know, you're in that moment. But then when you go to, you know, a scene that takes place 13 years before, the main story takes place in August 2019, and then we go back 13 years prior, and then slowly move back to 2019 again. But you're so invested in that one moment that it could almost throw you off and ruin the pacing of the film. It never does.
No.
And also, the thing that makes it even better is that when you do get to back to that match, your opinions do change on the characters and on the situation, or you have a greater appreciation or dislike for people. And so, like, that is great cinema in terms of the structuring of a narrative, where you can see a situation being laid out in one way, and then over time you become more sort of fully invested and realize who everybody is and what the story is. You see the whole picture
and what the stakes are and everything. Yeah. This movie fucking rocks, dude. Like, it's so good. I was flabbergasted, because I went back and watched the trailer with my wife Nevis after I'd already seen the movie, and I was amazed, because I remember the trailers dropping and I'm like, this looks like it could be fun, like a fun sports movie. And Luca's been, you know, hit or miss for me, but I've enjoyed his films overall, and I appreciate he has a vision and an aesthetic and stuff like that. But the movie's so much more unconventional than the trailer makes it out to be, because the trailer is very linear, kind of like tennis love story, love triangle
kind of, yeah.
And you do get that, but the way that it's structured, which Eric just so eloquently put, like, this one match, and even from the title treatments to it looking like a match on TV with the scores on the lower left corner, and the just everything is pitch perfect. And like, I was just, from everything from the music to like the Trent Reznor, Atticus Ross score is fucking incredible. We've both talked about this off air, but it is the first time Zendaya, I've really loved her in something, and she just fucking commands the screen in this entire movie. The two guys with Josh O'Connor and Mike Feist, who I like Mike Feist a lot in fucking
West Side Story.
But I think both of them are great. The use of, like, not like, at first it's hard when you go back 13 years and you're like, oh shit, okay, the same dudes are playing them. And you're like, okay, they just have longer hair and they're unshaven and stuff like that. But then the clothing of the time and stuff like that. Like, at first it was jarring, but you buy into it. And then it has this kind of soap opera love triangle, like lush, like sensual, sexy kind of story throughout that plays so well with like the tennis metaphors and things like that, that are both on the nose, but absolutely perfect. And then I think the script is fantastic. Like, I think both from that structure we mentioned, whether that was, I'm assuming, was built into the script. But then it also does such a fantastic use of dialogue that comes back up in the later act that adds to character growth or you know, anything like development and all this stuff. And like, and are fucking punches to the gut later in the movie as they come back. And you almost know that they're come back when they come back, but like when they do, you're like, fuck yeah. Like when something comes back at the end, I'm kind of rambling all over the place, but
it's hard not to, because I was floored by this. It's so amazing to watch how in control Luca Guadagnino is. And some of the things you just said in terms of describing this movie also describes the interests that he has. You know, you look at I Am Love, you look at Call Me By Your Name, you know, you even look at Bones and All. There's aspects of it where it is lush and sexy, and it's all about the human bodies, quite literally, in Bones and All. And, you know, he has a melodramatic flair, and it's very cinematic and operatic and can be maybe overpowering at times. But for this type of story, it works perfectly, because, you know, I'm not a sports guy, but watching you and my brother, you know, be so invested in watching, you know, hockey on a TV screen, you see that sort of excitement and passion in Zendaya's character and Tashi, and, you know, going from someone who, you know, is an aspiring prodigy to having a, you know, life-changing injury with a knee, and in terms of, you know, what she has to go through, and then becoming a coach, and then, you know, living vicariously through one of the other characters in terms of, you know, pushing as far as you can go, even though it's not you doing it, and you're kind of using an avatar in a way to do so. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, and the obsession, I think obsession is another thing that's so important with this, because you see, you know, and I'm looking at this from the autistic perspective of Zendaya, the way that she talks about tennis, it's such a part of her life. It consumes her in a way that, like, she has so much respect, not only for the sport playing it, but knowing it and knowing every aspect of it, that sometimes she could be perceived as cold or emotionless, you know, when she's in a relationship with somebody, or, you know, is she using somebody in order to get to a point where she wants to? She's ambitious. She has, you know, desires. And so we're watching that as well play out in such an interesting, very both progressive and I think fully realized in terms of each character. There's not one person in this love triangle that doesn't feel fully developed and doesn't feel like they have their own interior lives, and they're not just simply serving one of the other characters. Everybody has, you know, obviously there are love affairs and alliances, but there's also anger and hatred and just complete disrespect, and all this stuff works so beautifully. You know, I think, you know, Zendaya, this is a movie star performance for her. Yeah. And like you were saying, I liked her in the Spider-Man movies.
I've always liked her, but
I've never seen Euphoria, but I've always kind of felt like, oh, is this something that's been marketed to me, that I'm supposed to like Zendaya in the way that, like, oh, she's the greatest of all time. And it's like, she hasn't really earned it. And it's not necessarily her. It's more so the optics around her. With this, I get it, because the reaction shots, the expressive sort of looks that she has, and how she's calculating things, it's you're just glued into it. But I think the performance for me that I keep thinking about, and I'm really surprised by this, because I thought he was a second rate Hugh Grant, and I'm not even a Hugh Grant guy, I think Hugh Grant's awful, is Josh O'Connor. Yeah. I think Josh O'Connor as a dirtbag fuckboy is absolutely incredible. And you should kind of be rooting for him in certain scenes because of where he is in his life compared to where Zendaya and Mike Feist are in their lives. But then Zendaya kind of sets the record straight in a moment that's also very much going for the throat.
Oh my God, then you realize,
oh yeah, I shouldn't be rooting for this guy, even though, like, compared to the other two, he's at this stage. And yeah, you talked also about, you know, they're not relying here on makeup to age them up. I don't necessarily believe that they're in their late 30s, early 40s by 2019, but the haircuts and facial hair and clothing changes and the posturing and the performances all feel like, okay, you're seeing the evolution of the character throughout these 13 years. And each character feels like they've grown up, and in some ways they haven't. And that's also what makes it fascinating. And I think this movie also deserves, you know, we'll talk about the score in a second. I think the film also deserves a best makeup nomination for the actual scars and the wear and tear that bodies
take. What sports take. Yeah. What sports do to your body, like especially intense sports and things like that. Yeah. You know, I think the performances from all three of them in that, I think that's it shows any movie that uses like de-aging and things like that. And they're all relatively young. They're in, you know, Zendaya is only 27, you know, Josh O'Connor and Mike Feist in their mid 30s. So that makes sense for the 2019 sequence. But the way that they go back, although it's like jarring at first in that kind of, 90210 kind of 30-year-olds playing high schoolers kind of way, like where they're all supposed to be 17. And at first it is, but then you kind of, the performances are so good and the clothing and just the hairstyles and things like that. Like at first you're like, oh shit, okay, this works. And I wish more movies just did this in flashbacks, if you can make it work. And that slow drip with that going back to that, the Challengers match, and then going back in 13 years later, 10 years later, 8 years earlier, whatever, that's what I mean.
1 hour before.
Yeah. Like it's just perfect. And it develops these characters. And like you mentioned earlier, of revealing new things and putting different stakes on this match and showing you stuff that I don't even have the words for it. Just, it's so thoroughly entertaining. And like, I kind of thought of it of like one of these like sexy, like romance novels that like Nevis would read or something, or you'd pick up at an airport and read, like kind of thing, but the most like art house version of that. And it's not as like maybe cheesy as that at all. Like, I think it's very satisfying in that romantic relationship,
sensual, even.
It works on every single level. And I do think it's the sexiest movie to have Taco Bell, Applebee's Mountain Dew, and or not
Pepsi,
Mountain Dew,
Coke, Pepsi, Uniqlo, all your favorites are here.
Yeah, I just thought the Taco Bell bag before, like, it is very, it's just all these different things that I'm like, oh, this movie,
it's very contemporary too. Like, I think also that's why like it works so well, is because even the way that the characters, the relationships towards each other, you know, certain physical gestures or movements, or, you know, I was talking before about expressions, they're very relatable. Like, you see certain things and you know, okay, I know what this person
Dunkin' Donuts
is thinking, or I know what this person feels.
Yeah.
Or, you know, like again, you think, okay, well, it's partly, you know, the two guys going after the woman. There's something between the two guys as well. And that's also, I think, very revealing, even in, you know, a moment where, you know, Feist and Zendaya's characters are at Stanford, and you have Josh O'Connor's Patrick come in, and they're sitting and having a conversation, Feist and O'Connor, and O'Connor kind of pulls his seat closer to him. And that form of like those little gestures and intimacy in terms of the closeness and how people become more comfortable with each other and expressing sexuality in film. Because this movie, you know, as it is shown in the trailer, the sort of Y tu mama tambien kind of moments between the three, it's sexually charged, but it's not explicit. Yes. Like, there's nothing in the film that is gratuitous or exploitative or even so revealing that it's going to, you know, be the talking point in that way. It's just all, you know, window dressing in a lot of way, but it's how you think about it. It's how Guadagnino shoots bodies and, you know, very much
sweaty,
you know, he is a gay filmmaker muscular. And you can tell that, like, he appreciates the male form, and he's also very much respectful of the three performers in these very, very intimate moments. And it's not just simply the physical moments. It's the moments of conversations that I think really make a film like this just play to an audience. And it's a perfect match.
It really, really is.
And when you're watching it, I just feel like you are so, like, there were a couple times where I wanted to turn over to you and, like, give you a high five because I was like,
dude, I know.
I was so
we were both
happy.
Like pumping our fist. I was like slapping my leg. Like, I know a movie is really, really working when I audibly go, fuck yeah, under my breath. And you mentioned, like, wanting to lean over and, like, give you a high five. There are times during certain movies where I'm sitting with you where I want to, like, punch your leg beside me because I'm so fucking, like, amped up. And I made a few jokes when I noticed the Taco Bell or the Dunkin' or the
Applebee's. I could not stop laughing at that joke.
I was like,
made.
Applebee's really gets you going, man. And I think that was both from the tennis sequences, which when that fucking Trent Reznor, Atticus Ross score comes in and they're just awesome tennis sequences. But then you also get those moments from some of the dialogue, like I mentioned, whether it's like just really juicy, like fun dialogue, or if it's like shit that comes up that was kind of dropped earlier but doesn't feel forced or overwrought or anything like that. It just feels like, again, lush in a different way where you're like, ooh, this is like using this stuff against other characters in different way, or things taking on a different meaning as characters progress throughout the movie and or things are brought up. And then that leads you to like some of the relationship stuff, especially the love triangle. And, you know, there's even a joke to be made, like the metaphor of a relationship being a tennis match is something that, you know, it's not new necessarily, right? Especially people who are fighting or arguing and things like that. There's even people dunked on Sacha Baron Cohen and what's his ex-wife's name now?
Ilsa Fisher,
because when they announced their divorce, they did this weird tennis metaphor thing. And I think that could easily in this movie been like, kind of like, oh God, okay. Like, we get it. Like, okay. Relationships and testy ones can be like a tennis match. But the movie does such a good job, both of it in its cinematography, which is a lot. It's very kinetic throughout.
Yeah. Same cinematographer as Apichatpong Virasethakul.
Yeah.
And also the same guy who shot M. Night Shyamalan's upcoming movie Trap.
Oh, there we go. Toronto, baby. So I think the way that the cinematography, especially in the moments where characters are fighting, it's shot like it's that tennis match that you're seeing earlier, right? Which can be very on the nose and very obvious, but like it just works with the style of dialogue and the way that the movie's all set up, where you have the camera pan back and forth like it's a tennis match, and then you see that same cinematography sort of used in the actual tennis match. And then it's really creative and playful with its cinematography, which is, I know, a point you brought up as well, something that Luca Guadagnino and his cinematographers play with, where POV shots
Think
are used really, which again can be like off-putting in certain movies, but the way that it's used here, I think it's not going to be necessarily for everyone, but the POV shot of like the first person video game view or the POV of the ball, the tennis ball, I think is really,
or a ball being thrown into the hand of somebody. But Guadagnino does that. I mean, it's stylized, but I think here he's queuing you up for it, where I remember with A Bigger Splash, there was a moment, and I've maybe talked about this before, either on the show or on another review, where Matthias Schoenhart and Tilda Swinton's character in A Bigger Splash are going to the airport to meet Ralph Fiennes. And there's a moment where they enter the airport and it looked as though something went wrong with the projector, like maybe the light bulb kind of blew it or what have you, but it was dark.
Yeah.
When they entered the airport. And I was thinking, like, what is going on? This is really strange. And then Matthias Schoenhart, because it's a POV shot, takes off his sunglasses and it's back to the normal lighting again. And it's like shots like that. I'm like, that is so creatively inspired when you can find an interesting angle or shot that otherwise could probably be, you know, composed traditionally and just done in very kind of straightforward back and forth and relying completely on the editing. And even with the editing, there are moments in this movie that are so thrilling, but also funny. Like, I think this movie is a very funny film at times. Yeah. And there's one moment that I laughed at, and it's not like a big shot or anything, but it's, you know, you have Zendaya and you have Mike Face sitting in the locker room and he's chewing gum and he's nervous and, you know, they're about to walk outside of the locker room and, you know, he spits the gum into her hand and they walk in slow motion and the Reznor and Ross score plays. And then it's this abrupt cut to them sitting in the hotel room watching the match on TV. And it's so static in terms of its look, and it sets you up for this big moment that you're waiting for. Yeah, and then it cuts and it almost undercuts you because you're like, oh man, this is going to be great. And then you're like, oh, now you're watching it at home. And it weirdly feels like this kind of commentary on, like, this is a kind of movie that you, or with sports, maybe you get more out of it when you're there with the other people and you're feeding off of that adrenaline and excitement of watching the game in a communal experience. Mm-hmm. And, you know, like, anytime I see someone watch golf on TV, I'm always like, I don't know how you can do it. And, you know, I watch 3 to 4 hour art house movies that are paced like an iceberg, like, you know, melting. Yeah, like a golf match. And so, like, I have a super high tolerance when it comes to that stuff. But with golf, it's just like, I can't do it. But there are some people where it's like, they're glued
to it. It's thrilling, yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think if you understand a sport more, or you play a sport, sometimes that adds. And you don't have to. There are plenty of people who enjoy hockey or tennis or whatever and have never picked up a hockey stick or a tennis racket. But yeah, I think I love sports movies. And I do think this is Guadagnino's, like, most accessible thing. It will probably be easily his biggest movie because, like, I do think it's just...
It'll be his biggest splash?
Yeah. I just think it's, like, wholly accessible and, like, thoroughly entertaining. And I think having a movie star like Zendaya to kind of be that kind of anchor for the movie and to have this, you know, huge, like, not coming out party in this, because, like, she's been good in other things, but her, to your point, like, her as an actress, like, going like, oh shit, like, this is a commanding performance where she owns the screen. Like, she's great in Dune Part 2, she's great in the Spider-Man movies. Malcolm and Marie, we won't talk about, she's fine in it, she's the least of that movie's problems. But, like, I think will catapult this movie even to be a big deal. And I don't know if it's going to make a shit ton of money or anything, but, like,
but it could be a sleeper.
I think it will be a word of mouth film. Like, I really think it will be, because, like, from all the reactions, like, a bunch of us after the movie were like, holy shit, I think this might be my favorite movie of the year. Like, I think very different movies, but a good year for Zendaya, where this might bump Dune Part 2 out of, like, my top spot personally. I haven't seen a ton this year. I've been kind of slow with seeing stuff, but I just think this works as a great sports movie. This works as a great, you know, sexy, you know, like, love triangle film. Like, it works as this character study of these three characters, and, like, it gives you so much. But then there are also, like, little things that we haven't even talked about that I thought were done really well, and I don't want to get into here in case people haven't seen it, but, like, little character moments that give more about a character that they don't really even go into more, but you know how a certain character has maybe struggled and why his career hasn't taken off and, like, things like that. Like, it it has some very obvious dialogue that works just because it is that juicy kind of like stuff, but then it is more subtle in other moments, even though the movie is very fast paced and kinetic. And like, it's over 2 hours. It does not feel like it at all because the pacing is incredible. And to Eric's point, like, it, each time it rips you out of that match, it's not necessarily like, oh fuck, I wish I was just watching this tennis match. Like, each time you go back to it, because you're given a little bit more information, you are more into that match. And I think like how it plays out is like, you mentioned some of the comedic moments I think are very funny, and I think Luca's great at that stuff that is like over the top and melodramatic to the point where you're like laughing
the freeze frames.
Yeah and you're not like laughing at it per se, but
you're laughing in admiration
like,
of it.
Yeah, like you're like, I love the like bravado and the like the confidence almost in like his style and like and that kind of stuff. And Bones and All, we had those moments like near the end of the movie, I'm laughing, but I'm not laughing at the movie necessarily. I'm just laughing at the confidence almost in like a fuck yeah dude, go for it. And like,
and they do, and it feels like an action movie too. Yeah. Like, I would love to see Luca,
like,
Guadagnino,
Top Gun Maverick of like sexy sports movies.
Yeah. Like, except they're not wearing jeans while they're playing tennis, which would be very funny. But I would love now to see Luca Guadagnino do like a big budget action movie, like, because this to me felt as thrilling. You mentioned Top Gun Maverick, like it felt as thrilling as any summer blockbuster movie, but with the added bonus of, you know, the meaty dialogue and the sexuality and the sensuality and the playfulness with the structuring. Justin Koretzka's script, it's both, you know, very cinematic, but also the timing of it, I think, is really important as well. And I know, you know, you're in school right now for editing and post-production, and just looking at how they were able to devise, you know, the pacing of it, it's just sensational. You think to yourself, how do they keep the rhythm up throughout this whole thing and make it so... There's never really a dull moment, and I'm so close to giving this 5 out of 5. It's just that I want to see it one more time, just to take it in again. But it is truly one of the best sports movies ever made. It's one of Guadagnino's most... I've liked all of his stuff other than maybe the Suspiria remake.
Yeah,
but it's his most fun. Like, a lot of his movies, like, there are aspects of it where, you know, you mentioned bravado and just the pure joy of it. There's something where a lot of these movies end in misery or in pain or, you know, heartbreak. This ends in a way that maybe there is a little bit of that, but at the same time, it leaves you buzzing after the film. And that's the kind of thing I think we seek out when we're watching any kind of blockbuster film or movies in general. We want to have that feeling of, pun intended, I guess, euphoria that, you know, movies rarely give you. And like, afterwards, I felt like I had run like 30 laps and drank Gatorade and I was charged and I was ready to go.
I had
and
a fucking Dunkin' cold brew and ate Applebee's and had a fucking Crunchwrap.
It reminded me why I love this.
Yes.
Together. Like, all together. Like, everything about it, it hits.
I exactly feel the exact same way, and to use exact some more. I have to trust my gut when I feel that way after a movie. And you only get a couple of those per year. It's the same. And if that, sometimes you don't even get one of those, right? You like, there's movies you respect. There's movies that you appreciate. There's movies that you understand or a great film, or you can go, oh, that was excellent,
or you really really like but they don't go that final lap, you know?
And I think the last time, you know, we recency bias is a thing and all these things, and I have a fucking goldfish brain, but like it reminded me how I felt after Everything Everywhere All at Once, for a recent example, that buzzing is the perfect word. Like, you finish a movie and you go, holy fuck, I might have just seen one of my favorite movies of all time, not to be hyperbolic, but like one that will stand with that group of movies that I really fucking love. And, you know, it might play different on a rewatch and something like that. And maybe it is a little bit of recency bias, but like, I do have to trust myself when I when I am buzzing after a movie, and when you go and you just want to talk about it with other people and you want to bring up lines of dialogue, or you want to bring up a specific freeze frame or sequence, or and I know I've joked about it, but I love the movie's use of product placement in both a way that's funny and both a way that feels real in the world of like, yeah, these tennis players would have, you know, brand deals and things like that. But I think it's almost satirical sometimes, like with the Applebee's sequence or the Taco Bell bag.
Well, the Dunkin' Donuts. Yeah. I mean, this, I really, it's such a shame because I don't think they're doing it. If there was a tie-in with Dunkin' Donuts or Applebee's or Taco Bell, you know, like Dunkin' Donuts has like an actual, they're basically a character in one key little moment. And it's just so funny.
In any other
watch.
Movie that would not work at all.
No. Like, I don't know. Even some of the songs that we hear to kind of give you the decade, or even Blackberry, you know, Blackberry has a cameo in this as well. But like you have, you know, Bruce Springsteen's Tunnel of Love playing in the Applebee's, and like, you know, again, nothing is unintentional. Everything has a specific point to it. And there's almost a sense of humor to hearing that song in the Applebee's, or, you know, Nelly's Hot in here playing. And so you get the sense of the period, but also there, you know, there's a kind of tongue in cheek quality to some of the humor. And it did remind me a little bit of, I mentioned it in my tweet, where like in terms of like sort of the throuple thing, or, you know, sort of three characters sort of intertwined in a romance, it has the qualities of Jules and Jim. And the one thing that Jules and Jim was never able to completely explore because of the time and the history, the Truffaut movie, was sort of the queer side of things. And so this movie does, and it explores those aspects, and it's not afraid to, it's not hesitant to, and
it doesn't even make it like a weird thing or anything.
No, it feels very, it's like, natural. It doesn't feel like it exoticizes it, or it doesn't feel like you're watching this thing and, you know, it's taking a moment to sort of relish in it in the way that, like, when you're in your teens and you're watching American Pie, and you know you look at it then and you're like, oh, like I'm seeing, you know, Shannon Elizabeth naked for the first time or something like that. But then you get older and you're kind of like, that kind of feels a little bit icky now in terms of how the character's portrayed and also what happens to her. This treats sexuality and the performances in a very honest and sensual way that, as to describe the way that you described the prime bottle in the WrestleMania, it's tasteful and subtle
in the middle of the ring.
I
agree completely. And I think the other thing why this movie hit too is like those flashback sequences going back to 2006, and those characters being in university or college at that time. And they're the same age as us, basically, in these movies, right? So they flash back to when they're 17 years old in 2006. And I'm like, oh, shit, all these characters were born in 1989 or 88 or something like that, right? So we're getting to that point now where the flashbacks in movies are coming of age stuff. So, and we're the same age as these characters. So there was also this Baja blast of nostalgia that throughout this movie that I wasn't expecting, right? Because the characters are in their mid-30s, I guess, in 2024, and they're 30 in 2019, essentially, when the movie mostly takes place. But all these flashbacks are time periods where I was the exact same and you were the exact same age as these characters. So the clothing they're wearing, the Gatorade bottles they're drinking from, and I made fun of that shit in Madam Web, right? And there's the same, it's the same similar time periods. You see the same Pepsi logos and stuff like that.
And we
that.
Grew up in that, like, period, so that's we're what very I mean. Aware so, of it.
So like when you see it all, it was just this rush of nostalgia in this way where you're like, holy fuck, I'm getting old. We're getting flashbacks to these areas that are so, like, the way that the characters dressed and the hairstyles. It's just like, holy crap, this is like...
Didn't see any puka shell necklaces, though.
No, but it didn't seem like the vibe of these characters, right? But like... Right.
Although I would argue I could see Mike Feist sporting a puka shell necklace when he has kind of the shaggy dog kind of look. Hair,
which was huge back then. And like, it's that... I think branding and brands are a perfect way to send you back to a certain era, right? Without having to show cars or another thing, but even cars are a type of like branding and stuff like that. So
when do you think is the first movie for you that you kind of felt like the nostalgia was of your time?
I would reference Lady Bird.
I was going to say just that as well. 2003. It's like, no.
And that was the first time. Not the exact first time. Other movies, I'm sure, have flashed back to the 2000s or whatever. But like, I think when it gets to that period in the 2000s, when we were between 13 and 18 years old, right?
Yeah.
Like, and that doesn't seem that long ago in my brain. But then when you start to think like, oh, 13 years ago or 15 years ago or whatever, when it flashes back to those moments or even more, right? When we become 36, which is pretty soon for both of us, like that's 18 times two, right? Is 36. Yeah. And so like you've lived another life since becoming 18. You're 2 18-year-olds, right? And now we're getting existential and shit for Challengers, which is just a thrilling.
But there's an aspect
movies,
of that, though, like, I think as well in terms of how time plays a role in the athletes,
and
the athlete's life. Yeah, like, you know, I always talk to you and Kyle about how, you know, in hockey terms,
30 is fucking ancient.
Yeah. You know, like when you're a prospect, you're in your teens.
Yeah. And you break into the league as an 18-year-old, and same with tennis, right? Like you can go pro, I think, when you're 17, when you're 18 years old. Right. So when it is actually a great point, Eric, because like in sports, it's the only place where, you know, if you're in your mid 30s, you are an elder statesman or woman or them. Like it's just like you are old as fuck, but then like you are ready to retire at 31 32, right? You're starting to become slower and older and like
and physically like the toll it's taken on your body.
So I think that's why this movie might hit for people in their 30s, right? Like because I feel like we're still very young, and we still have a lot of life to go. But when it comes to sports specifically, you start to, you know, see your age and when you flash back that far and you're like, it doesn't feel like that long ago, but how much happens to bring this full circle in that 13 years to lead up to this Challengers game that they're having. There's so much life there, right? Where it's just, it feels like yesterday, but then so much has happened in that 13 years. So I think when you apply that and you see these brands and see the clothing and stuff, especially if you're people of our age, I think it's going to hit really hard. And just to sum it up, Trent Reznor and Atticus Ross, I know we brought it up. Oh my God, man. Like they are the best. And like I feel like a movie, music can either distract, it can also be subtle enough where you're not even paying attention to it. There can be themes like in superhero movies where they repeat and, you know, hero themes for different characters and stuff like that.
Well, even but, composers, right? Like you look at a composer, it's like, are they being sort of spread thin in the way that, you know, you're getting the same sound so much that you can't appreciate when they were first original. Yeah, and so you think
Danny
about
Elfman.
Like, yeah, the perfect example of that. And with The Social Network, you know, being as long ago as it was now.
I know,
you think,
man.
Oh, are they repeating themselves? But this music sounds weirdly not of the period that they're in. It almost sounds like 90s electronic house music.
Yeah.
And it works so perfectly. Like I wanted to break out some glow sticks and start like beating in the theater and be like, yeah, it just works perfectly.
Anytime it comes on, like when it just kicks in, because the movie has licensed music, like you mentioned. And it's some of that stuff the juxtaposition between the score and some of the licensed music is very interesting. But when that score kicks in and it is this 90s house, like fucking fist pumping, like heart pounding kind of electro synth music, like it's just, I immediately, a smile is on my face and you're just like, it just added to the kinetic kind of energy to the movie. And for those guys, like, you know, I know they were sparsely used in film for a little while, But, you know, obviously picked up after Social Network. They've done a great job of, I'm always excited when they're added to a film or it's announced that they're doing the score to a film.
Like, well, especially with Fincher, right? Like, cause Fincher, yeah, you know, starting with The Social Network and even, you know, recently with The Killer, they always feel like, okay, they're at home with him. But then when they venture outside, you know, there are times where like you look at something like mid-90s, there's really not much
even
there.
Ninja Turtles, I'd say.
Like, yeah. It didn't, but then really, Soul, like, is so, yeah, beautiful and it's so different from a lot of the other stuff they've done. And even though like Mank, you know, is in the Fincher wheelhouse, at least they're trying something that's appropriate to the time period. And now working with Luca Guadagnino on this, it just feels like, again, they're expanding their horizons in a way. You would never think that Trent Reznor would become this critically acclaimed and, you know, award lauded composer. I mean, I always liked Trent Reznor and I liked Nine Inch Nails from like that emo high school teen point of view, but it's such a weird thing. It's, you know, like it's nice to see, like, talking about people growing up. He seems to have matured so much in the time that he's gone from, you know, being the kind of alternative rock metal bad boy type that's provocative and pushing the envelope to becoming this. It's like, I mean, there are not many musicians that you could say of that period or even into the early 2000s. Like, could you imagine if Fred Durst became, you know,
award-winning film composer?
Yeah. Yeah. So it's a testament to how versatile I think both of those guys are. And just thinking about, like, you should never judge anybody based on, like, you know, there's the potential for them to grow. And I think it's great.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I'm going through and, you know, Empire of Light, I forgot they did the score for and stuff like that. But like Mank, I don't particularly, it's very different, but like their Watchmen score is incredible. Waves and their score is incredible. You know, they've done a lot since
Patriot Social Day Network, is really good. Yeah. I remember
Patriot
as well.
Day was great too, man. So like, and they don't seem like they're overused yet, right? Like it does seem like they only pop in maybe 1-2 movies a year, sometimes 3, but like depending on who they like to work with. But it's when you say they go out of their comfort zone and do something like Soul and even Ninja Turtles to an extent, doing like a, you know, a quote unquote kids movie and stuff like that, like it still has an interesting sound to it, even though it's not maybe one of their more memorable scores. But in this, I've had those remixes on and I can't wait for the actual full album to come out, which will probably come out next week. And it will be there with Social Network, with Soul, with Watchmen, that like, those are scores that I listen to constantly because it's great working music. It just either will get you amped up or it's just like easy, not easy listening, but you know what I mean by that.
But no, you're, like, it feels like it's a way to kind of like wake you up and get you in the mood. And it has a way of, you go along with the rhythm. Like there was times watching this movie and I'm sure you were as well, where I felt like I was going dun, 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 dun. No, and I was totally with, man.
It helps with the
pulsating
of, yeah,
of the music. It's interesting because they're also working with Guadagnino on Queer with Justin Kreskis, the screenwriter as well. And Kreskis is Celine Song's partner in real life of past lives. And even that is fascinating to dissect in terms of love triangles in both of these movies, in almost the same way that you could look at Lost in Translation and Her as conversations about the same sort of, you know, flip side to the same story in a way. Not that Past Lives and Challengers are the same in terms of their narrative structure or dealing with loneliness or something like that, but in terms of like looking at the dynamics of three characters caught in a love triangle and exploring those relationships, it's fascinating that these two movies are coming from this couple.
Yeah. The movie absolutely fucking rips. You should immediately go see it. If you've already seen it, I hope you loved it. I hope it lived up to the hype that is starting to build around it. And I just have this odd feeling that this movie will carry throughout the year. Like, I do think that this is going to be a crowd pleaser. I think it's going to be talked about for the rest of the year. I think it's my favorite Luca Guadagnino movie. It's probably my favorite movie of the year so far. And like I said, you only get a couple of these, you know, every year. There's usually like one or two movies that I'm like really fucking, if in a good year it can be more, but like that you're, to Eric's point, buzzing after. So I am going to give the movie a 5 out of 5. I hand 5 out of 5s out, you know, fairly willy-nilly.
Yeah, Madam Web, this.
Yeah, I'm going to serve up. I'm serving up a 5 out of 5 for this. I just, I have to trust like that fucking buzzing feeling after. So 5 out of 5 for me.
I'm so close. I'm 4.5 out of 5, but
4.75 out of 5.
That is the other thing that we should mention as well. I think like the buzz was there, but the other thing is, as soon as that movie ended, and this is also a good sign, I could have watched it again.
Oh, absolutely. I cannot wait to watch it again.
Yeah. And I think that's also telling of like how good a movie this is and how entertaining it is. But there's more meat on the bone than just simply being entertainment. Like there's so much to appreciate and dissect and think about. But ultimately, I think it's the feeling that it gives you that will reward you as a moviegoer.
Yeah.
And it does. Yeah. It does not feel like 2+ hours. It feels like it's like 20 minutes. Like it just, it goes by.
Yeah. That's awesome. Thank you all for listening or watching. We really do appreciate it. Please go check out all of our other reviews. We have reviews out for X-Men 97, Godzilla, Kong, A New Empire. Civil War is up for you guys right now. We're a little late on that, but full spoilers on that one over there. So check that out. I think Eric and I had a really good conversation. And Eric, you've had a bunch of interviews the last little while. Do you want to play?
Well, it was funny because the morning of Challengers, I was so stressed out because I had an interview with Caitlin Cronenberg for Humane in the afternoon, and the fine people at Taro PR were able to sort of arrange that and make it work, and I really appreciate it. But you know, when you have something that's on your mind and you can't think about anything else, and it kind of ruins everything else that you're doing.
Yeah, I usually, if meantime, I have one thing in the afternoon, I can't do anything until then. Usually.
Yeah, Challengers relieved my stress. You know what? Fuck this. I'm giving it 5 out of 5.
Yes,
this Challengers relieved my stress, and I felt like I was so excited for the rest of the day. Like that's how good an experience.
I went on the picket line with my wife and I was like, I'm staying here all day with you.
You're like, I'm a challenger. I'll challenge you guys. Pay the people what they deserve. You know, support Nevis, support the workers. And I hope that that's resolved soon, but you know, pay what's fair. So fuck it. 5 out of 5.
Hell yeah, dude. Untitled underscore movies over on Letterboxd. Follow me on all those social medias at Matt Rohrbeck.
And you can find more of my video reviews on RogersTV.com/cinemascene. And on here as well, you know, I have an interview with Alex Garland for Civil War. As I mentioned, Caitlin Cronenberg will be coming up soon for Humane. There's an interview for Irina's Vow with Sophie Nelisse, who's also seen on the TV show Yellow Jackets. Louise Archambault, the director of Irina's Vow. I also had a quick conversation with, which was very nice. And then an interview coming up for the film, Do Not Expect Too Much from the End of the World. So there's a lot of interviews coming up, Matt. And then we also have a really wonderful review of X-Men 97, which is crushing it right now.
Oh my God. Talk about another thing that has taken the world by storm. Just like, no pun intended. All right. Until next time.
I think you nailed it there.
I want some Dunkin' Donuts so bad. Bring it to Canada. What are you doing?
I'm going to Applebee's. There's one in Ajax.
Is there still one in Ajax?
Oh, yeah. Oh, it's there, baby. And I'm going to get aroused by that Applebee's.
You're going to, yeah. Bye, everybody.